danger is stealing in as relapse comes above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 271 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Baltimore, Maryland, I'm Andrew Brokus. I'll be joined shortly by Nate Mavis and by Danny Sprung. Some of you may remember Danny Sprung. He was previously a guest on episode 194 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. Back then, Danny was primarily a trader and a bridge player. I actually messed this up during our interview, and I owe Danny an apology for this, but Danny actually had been a serious poker player since even before the moneymaker boom, and had just kind of, I don't know, fallen out of practice is exactly the right word, but I think was when we first spoke to him in November of 2016, was just starting to take poker seriously again. Hopefully I'm recalling that correctly this time, but as you'll see, he's had quite a bit of improvement and success in the nearly 2 years since then, culminating in a 12th place finish at the Monster Stack event, which is one of the largest field events in the World Series of Poker during the 2018 World Series of Poker, and that was good for more than $70,000. So pretty nice breakthrough there for Danny. And as you'll hear, we're going to be talking strategy with Danny, discussing a few hands from the Monster Stacks. I'm just going to go ahead and tell you about our strategy sponsor now. As you'll hear, Danny actually attributes a fair amount of his recent success to Tournament Poker Edge, and I can testify, and I do testify during the interview, that I've seen that progress on Danny's part. Danny's one of the more active posters on the TPE forums, and I've just seen the changes in the sophistication of how he's thinking about poker. I've seen that evolution over the course of the last 2 years of his posting on Tournament Poker Edge, and I'm not surprised to see that he had a successful summer at the World Series of Poker. You too can experience success with Tournament Poker Edge for as little as $25 a month. Check it out at tournamentpokeredge.com. Danny, thanks so much. You're joining us from, is it the World Bridge Championships in Orlando?
Yes, that's correct. Thanks for having me again.
Oh, it's our pleasure. As we were just saying on our interview with Matt Glassman, it seems like you've changed and improved quite a bit as a poker player since the last time we spoke to you. And you know, in particular, congratulations on that deep run in Monster Stack. That must have been fun.
Oh, yes, that was a blast. It was so much fun playing and doing well, and even the money aside, it was great, but, you know, obviously getting paid to do well was even more fun, so it was all good. Had a great time with that.
And how's it going at the Bridge World Championships?
So we played in the first event is called the Rosenblum Teams. It's an open teams event to anybody in the world, and it's set up in such a way that you can play with anybody. It's not a national event like some of the other world championships. And we had a pair from Canada and a pair from Scotland on our team. And our team was originally seeded in about 50th. But the way they run the tournament, they run a two-day Swiss, and the top 64 teams make what's the equivalent of like a March Madness bracket, so 64 teams make it. And we did quite well in that phase of the tournament. We actually came in seventh, which is obviously much better than where our prediction would be. And with that, we got to choose our first opponents. We chose a team that we had played the previous day and did quite well against. Unfortunately, they played better the next time we played against them, and we lost in the round of 64. So we're now on the sidelines for that event. There are other events, just like in a poker tournament, there's four or five different events. There's a teams and then an open pairs, and then the next event that my wife and I are going to play in is the mixed teams.
Yeah, so. I was going to ask you how the World Series, or not World Series of Bridge, the World Championship of Bridge compares to the World Series of online poker. I mean, does it feel at all similar?
Yeah, it feels a lot similar in a lot of ways. You know, you're getting all the best players in the world to come to one place at the same time, which is a great thing. You know, one of their mottos is Bridge for Peace, so that's one of the reasons why people can play with different teams from other countries. You don't have to play within your country, so it's less, you know, tribalistic, nationalistic. It's more just trying to find the best players and such. And, yeah, I mean, obviously it's not as big, Bridge being a sport on the decline and poker being still on the way up. The attendance here is nothing like what we would get you would get at the Rio for the World Series of Poker. So,
but I mean, culturally, I think of the World Series as kind of a place where you get a gathering of, yes, the best players in the world, but also just enthusiasts. I mean, you get people who are playing at all different levels, you know, including some people who are not going to play a bracelet event at all, but just kind of want to be around for it. Like, it strikes me in part as just kind of a convention of poker enthusiasts. I mean, are there lots of like side games and things like that going on during the Bridge Championships, or is it more just for serious players?
So for the ACBL National Championships, it's exactly like what you described. There's main events, and then there's events from the top all the way down. There's four or five or six different levels of events, whereas here at the World Series, they just mainly have the main events, and there's not much for enthusiasts who aren't really that very good. But that being said, the events are all open to anybody who is of good standing in their country. So you do get some less talented players, but not you would see much more like what you described with the different levels at an ACBL national event.
Now that,
because there are events that are... Sorry?
No, go ahead.
There are events that are specifically designed at the ACBL tournaments, at the American Contract Bridge League tournaments, where that are limited so that the very best players can't play, and players of different levels have better chances of winning, which attracts more people. Mm-hmm. When you limit it to just open events, that discourages people who don't really have much of a chance of doing well. Some people will come and just play because they want to play against the very best, and I admire that, and I think that's great. It's sort of like the same situation you have with poker, in that you can tee it up with the best players in the world, whereas in most other endeavors, you'll never have a chance of playing golf with Tiger Woods or basketball with LeBron James or such like that.
This phenomenon of being winning the right to choose your opponent, is that a common thing in Bridge? It's very notable to me.
There are a couple of events that use that, in that it's very hard to actually seed a tournament in the traditional way, because everybody has different levels of what events they've played in. So when you have a 2 or 3 day qualifying, one of the rewards for doing quite well is the choosing of your opponents. Now that can be a double-edged sword, because you choose somebody and they're like galvanized, oh, these guys don't think we can play, and then they're really, you know, they come after you to beat you.
It's the ultimate bulletin board material, really.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
It makes me want to create a poker tournament that's like a bunch of heads-up matches, and you have like seeding rounds, and then there's like money matches where the people who do the best get to choose their opponents from everybody else. I think that could actually do pretty well.
Yeah, that's a great idea. And with poker with heads up, that would be even more of an ego situation, and more like you chose me kind of stuff, and
yeah,
I'll show
yeah.
you.
And there's a lot of stuff about like, and also a big skill decision, because matching up styles is a big, like, what I used to be a heads up regular, and I would definitely pass up games against weaker opponents and sit in games against stronger opponents based on like style matchup and how I thought. How I thought that went, like specifically how I thought I could do personally against them. I think this might have
right,
some legs. I think this might have some legs. Anyway, back to Bridge.
Fun idea, yeah.
So you had an interesting qualifier in there that players who were in good standing in their respective countries were open to play. What exactly goes into being in good standing?
Mainly having a clean record as far as ethics and cheating are concerned. I think I mentioned on the last podcast that Bridges had a lot of issues with that. And in fact, recently there's been a big expose of the blue team, which was the Italian team from 1958 to 1975 that basically never lost an open international match.
Yeah.
And there was a book that just published and was available for purchase here at the tournament starting the day before yesterday. So it's, and I've been reading it in my free time since then. So there's a lot of issues with cheating, and the, you know, one of the teams that won 17 world championships now is considered to have been most if not all the players on that team are accused of and just widely suspected of cheating to win those events.
Wow.
Right. So like so, on a scale from like say Scrabble, where my sense is that it's mostly clean but occasionally somebody's like palming an E or an S or whatever, to like cycling, where I mean it's hard to find. I mean, I don't know what it is now, but like, you know, let's just say the distinction between, you know, like even asking the question who was,
you can see their mannerisms. There wasn't anything that was hidden from view, so you could easily divide signals, whether it would be how you held your hand, whether you were smoking your cigarette or not, what you did with your score pencil, on and on and on. But since 1975, they created something called a screen that goes across the table, so you cannot see your partner during the play. So that eliminated a lot of the obvious ways of cheating. Now, since then, there have been other ways people have found around that, including coughing and the spacing of their bidding cards or the orientation of which way they play their cards. If they play their card facing their partner, it would mean one thing. If they play their card facing their opponents, it might mean a different thing. So those are the sorts of things that still went on, and people have rooted out a lot of those problems, but they're still issues that are definitely out there that, you know, nobody thinks that the game is 100% clean yet, but everybody likes to think that we're better than we were 3 years ago.
Has this made you more paranoid about, well, maybe not more, because I guess you started playing poker after you were already playing bridge, but, I mean, I guess, does this make you paranoid about cheating in poker? It seems like the incentive to cheat at somewhere like the World Series of Poker is much higher. I guess maybe it's somewhat more difficult to do as well, since you don't have a partner so readily available.
Right, yes. I find myself very unparanoid about cheating at poker. I don't have this feeling like, you know, something bad has happened, whereas your antenna goes up when something bad happens at bridge. It rarely does with poker with me. The one issue is if you get into a smaller tournament, especially like a satellite, and everybody knows each other, the collusive incentives are there, and that certainly can happen. But, most of the tournaments I play, either at the World Series or at the Venetian or my local card room, whatever, I don't have that feeling like that's going on at all. I mean, I just, you know, even the people who seem to know each other don't seem to soft play each other. They, if anything, they play harder against each other than the other way around. So, and it has made me more paranoid about bridge, though, that, you know, whenever I'm playing against somebody who's, I think, well, you know, maybe they're doing something with their leads, or maybe they're doing something with the way they're, you know, they're carding or whatever, it just makes me a little more uncomfortable and a little, you know, sad when I look back at some of the tournaments we've played and we've done well, but then we lost to one of the teams that turned out to be cheating. It was very, you know, it was a little disconcerting.
Yeah. Do you feel like it affects your play once you start to get, so I mean, if you're playing with someone and you kind of find yourself wondering, he put his card out, and like you're saying, the orientation of the card could potentially mean something, but it could also just be nothing. So, I mean, how much does it like throw you off your game if you find you start wondering, are you just paranoid all the time, I guess?
Not really. In fact, you know, if I think that something bad's going on, I try not to think about it. And then after the game is over, there's enough to think about during the game for your own play, not to be trying to analyze how your opponent's cheated. But then if you go back over the hand later and you see a pattern that doesn't strike you as right, or there was a particular bid that was very suspect, then there's ways of reporting that to the authorities so they can start collecting evidence on pairs that cheat. And we have done that in the past with a few pairs.
I'm reminded of, have you read The Art of Learning, Josh Waitzkin's book?
No, I'd like to read that, actually. That sounds like a good thing. I read Searching for Bobby Fischer, so...
Yeah, I think it's pretty good. I mean, it has very obvious, there's very obvious reasons why it would be of interest to a poker, or probably a bridge player also, but he describes being in some, it's called push hands, it's the sort of competitive
Tai Chi, maybe is a fair way of describing it. I hadn't heard it before reading the book, but he describes being in some situations where there was very obvious favoritism towards, I forget which country it was in, but, you know, American players or non-Asian competitors were sort of looked down upon, or, you know, people didn't want them to win it might have been the Taiwanese national championships, and he felt like there was some very clear favoritism on the part of the judges, and just kind of needing to compete at a highest level, even knowing that was definitely happening, not even, you know, there's a chance of it happening, but needing to compete at a high level just with the open awareness that he was going to be treated unfairly by the judges. It seemed like an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, that's, you know, especially in something where there's judgment going on, or, you know, like a figure skating or boxing, where there can be, you know, that sort of really makes the game less appealing to me, for sure. I mean, in bridge or poker, there's none of that. It's, you know, the cards speak, and what happens, happens.
Right, that was part of what was so striking about it to me, was I couldn't imagine myself even wanting to compete under those conditions, and he seemed prepared to just kind of say, well, it's just part of the game that I'm going to have to deal with.
Right, well, I mean, if it's something, you know, all these games, they all start out with a passion for the actual game, or, you know, if it's Tai Chi, if it's a discipline or whatever you want to call it, they all start out with a passion. If you have that passion, you're going to want to, you know, feed that to its logical end. So I can understand why, well, you know, that's part of the game, we have to fight that, and that is what it is, but, you know, I can understand him thinking that way too.
So this was your second World Series of Poker, 2017?
No, I played in more. I actually played my first World Series of Poker in either 1999 or 2000. I played in the Lemon Hold'em event, first event back then. So way back then I played. And then since I moved to Vegas in 2012, I think I've played in at least one event almost every year since then. So
I'm misremembering badly then.
No. Yeah, I've played not as many events. You know, when I first got there, I might have played one, you know, moved to Vegas, I might have played one or two events. This year I played more than that, obviously.
Yeah, and I ran into you other places. Like, I know we played together at the Venetian. I mean, were you doing sort of a full or approximately full tournament schedule this year?
No, I don't really have the stamina or desire to play poker multiple days in a row, especially if I'm doing well. And then, you know, after the monster stack, I didn't really want to play poker for another few days after that. So it's not in my makeup to want to play 6 or 7 days a week. Mm. So I played a few Venetian events. I played at the Wynn once or twice. I ran into Carlos there. We played a few orbits together, and I played at the Rio. That was it. I probably played maybe 10 or 12 events during the summer.
But how did you
being
choose...
in Vegas full?
Sorry, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, being in Vegas full time, I don't feel the urge to have to like cram a lot of tournaments in during those 6 weeks, because after everybody goes home, there's still Venetian Series and Wynn Series and the local tournaments at Red Rock and such. So there's, you know, I can space it out a little better without having to play every day.
So knowing that you're only going to play a pretty limited schedule during the summer, you know, how did you put together what events you were going to play?
Well, I looked at the events that have, you know, better structures, like the Monster Stack, and some of the Venetian events tend to start with more chips. I especially like tournaments that are multi-day that have more than one first day. So if there's like a day 1A and a day 1B, I can play day 1A, not play the next day, and then come back day two more refreshed than I would otherwise. Mm-hmm. So those are events I definitely targeted as, you know, either a 1 day event or an event where the second day will be after a break. And, you know, I like, you know, events like the Millionaire Maker or the Monster Stack, where you're going to get bigger, softer fields. You know, they have a little more appeal. I'm not so thrilled with some of the Rio events that don't give you a lot of chips to start with. I mean, I played one flight of the Colossus, and even though I was doing well early on, everybody else was already in push-shove mode in, like, the third or fourth level, and you get to the point where, well, you're calling them because you're supposed to call them, and then all of a sudden you find yourself in that, and so it's, like, not really a structure that appeals to me, so.
Yeah, I definitely don't think that those are fun events to play. From a professional's standpoint, they do tend to be pretty good hourly rate. Like Colossus in particular is a pretty good hourly rate because they are often over quickly. So you sort of either get your EV or you go home.
Right.
You know, that can be a nice thing. But yeah, it feels a lot more like work when I'm doing that. Like it's not any of what I enjoy about poker. I'm just kind of, you know, sitting around hoping that some value is gonna fall into my lap, and so it's not gonna happen if I'm not there, but I'm not enjoying being there in the same way that I am during like the main event or something where there's really some interesting poker being played.
Yeah, and as a more recreational player, part of the EV is actually getting to play,
right,
as opposed to the dollar amount. So right. being done at 2 o'clock when you were hoping to schedule a full day of poker doesn't really appeal too much.
Yeah, that's not an upset.
And, you know, obviously, yeah. Rebuying with like, you know, 12 big blinds left, that has no appeal at all, so I just don't see that.
So, I guess it's hard not to be biased, but what was your favorite event that you played this summer?
Well, obviously the Monster Stack doing well, and that was great, and, you know, playing in the main event is always a lot of fun, too, so it's, you know, it's hard to say that the main event isn't a great event too. Having done well in the Monster Stack, that will certainly have fond memories for me.
I don't want to inadvertently needle you, but how did the main event go for you?
So the main event, the first day went quite well. I started out first couple of hours, just every hand I either had ace king and lost or lost to ace king. So I went from like 50,000 to say 20,000. Fairly quickly, but by the end of the day, I had gotten it up to about 95 or 97,000, something like that. And the second day, I got, I was scheduled to play at the highest number table, so I knew right away that my table wasn't gonna be there. I was gonna be shuffled off to some other table, and I ended up at a very tough table with four or five pros who I didn't know, and then Scotty Nguyen and Carrie Katz were. I was in between those two guys, so. It felt like a pretty tough table, and I won one or two hands, and then I just kept having second best hands like all day, and ended up losing on a one outer all in for about 65,000 near the end of the second day. So it wasn't, you know, I feel like I used up a lot of my run good in the main and the monster stack, so I'm trying to be philosophical about all the, you know, the beats that I take or the one outers or the flips that I lose and such like that. It's just, that's just going to happen, and I remind myself that I had a really nice run with some good luck in that event, and don't, you know, try to be philosophical about it.
Yeah, I think that's the attitude you have to have.
Yeah. I mean, it's easier to have when you have a nice score under your belt, as opposed to when you think about your year and it's been going kind of frustratingly, and then, you know, another frustrating thing happens, and
right.
you're thinking like, well, when am I ever going to get the good part of the
yeah.
variance? And having had that good part of the variance for at least for the rest of this year, it's like, you know, that's going to be, that cash is going to be more than I would do in buy-ins in a typical year, so it's like I can't possibly lose this year, so that feels good.
How is playing with Scotty Nguyen? I've never actually played with him.
He's a little chatty. I mean, he's fine. He plays pretty straightforwardly. Nothing too crazy. I mean, he did one thing that kind of irritated me a little bit. I had, he was under the gun and raised, and I was next to act, and I had aces, and I three bet him. And it folded to the guy who to my left, so under the gun plus three, I guess, who four bet. And it folded back to Scotty, who picked up his hand and showed it to the other rest of the table and said, here, look what I'm folding.
Oh, wow.
And folded
it. Yeah, it's really bad.
Which I think, you know, I'm not sure what to make of that as far as what hand that is, you know. I don't have the experience to know, all right, what hand is he showing? Oh, look at this great fold. What am I making?
Jack's or ace king.
Yeah, it turned out he said later on that it was ace king. So it came back to me, and then I had to decide whether to five bet or just to flat the guy, and I ended up five betting, and he folded king's face up. So that was a little frustrating. But.
Well, so he didn't show the cards to your opponent. He showed it to everyone except you and the other player with live cards.
Right.
Is that okay?
we were, the three of us were sort of on one end of the table, and he showed the other end of the table. It wasn't like he showed it in such a way that the other guys could see, but, you know, and obviously he's making some sort of lay down when he folds, but, you know, the fact that he's folding is information that's known. It's just, all right, I'm making this big fold.
Right. No, I still think it's something he probably shouldn't, you know, anything that has the potential to influence the action. Like, I just think it's better to err on the side of not doing stuff like that, basically.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, but, this is... If it makes you feel any better, he once walked up to me, and we were more or less strangers. Like, we'd, like, briefly said hello earlier in the evening. I was playing a cash game at Casino Arizona, and I just felt an arm around my shoulder, and I looked up, and it was Scotty Wynn, and he, without asking, picked up my, like peeled back my cards I had raised already, and looked at them and said, "Oh, you play worse cards than I do, baby." I did not win that pot.
You got a good really story bad. Out of it, though. Depending on the stakes, it might be worth more than the pot.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it cost me somewhere between $15 and $50. $50 would be a lot of money. I don't think it was that much, but I remember it fondly, and I don't know. Casino Arizona, it was that kind of place. You just sort of rolled with the punches. It was a well-run place for the most part.
Yeah, I think Scotty keeps the game more, a little less serious, a little more friendly, and a little more, you know, he's a little chatty at the table and stuff. I think that's probably better for poker than just, you know, the proverbial nine guys with hoodies and headphones on.
Yeah.
So I think that is better for the game in general. And obviously, he's obviously a TV attraction. So that's good for, you know, for Parker too. So,
yeah. So disorienting how old he looks now, though. I mean, sorry, Scotty, if you're listening, which you're not. If you are listening, you should definitely write in. But it's disorienting, like, when you see somebody like Daniel Negreanu or Scotty Wynn looking, like, vastly older than they did in 1990 or 1995.
He did say one thing funny. He said he bet that he had more kids than the rest of the table combined.
Huh.
Which I found to be a little amusing. Like, how many kids do you have?
Yeah.
He said, "Oh, I don't want to tell you." Must be a lot, though.
Is this like a Wilt Chamberlain of poker or some kind of thing? Is that what he's saying?
I guess. I mean, more that he's actually fathered the kids than just, you know, just the different women he slept with. But
yeah, that's very strange. That's real. That's weird.
Yeah.
I'm sure we asked this to you last time, but do you find poker affecting your bridge more or less or not at all?
I find when I played a bunch of bridge and go back to poker or vice versa, I think that each time I get a little better at the other game because it enables you to think differently about both, you know, there's some similarities and I think you talked about this with Matt as far as like ranges and stuff. But just the idea of how to think about a hand, whether it be a poker hand or a bridge hand, I think it helps you with each one. Each game helps with the other, and you know, we've mentioned before the idea that a lot of bridge players could be real successful at poker if they put their mind to it, and vice versa, maybe. But I think it does help. Each game helps the other a little bit, even if it's not a lot. It's just an incremental help. Okay. So yeah.
How much is bridge sort of getting older? Like, is it going to be like boxing in 40 years, where it's like a niche thing, but it's still a thing? Or is it going to be like jacks, where it's like just an old-fashioned game that you would only play to step into the past?
Yeah, I'm hoping that it's not going to be that bad. I mean, it's already, you know, the average age of a tournament bridge player is already, you know, pushing 70.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it's bad. But I mean, they tried to run some youth programs here in the U.S., and it didn't work especially well, but there are parts of the world, most notably China and some places in Europe, that they really are pushing for young kids. In fact, they have a youth championship here in Orlando. And I think of the 26 pairs, 23 of them were for China.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the Chinese are, they government pays their players, their people to play, and they teach it in schools. And they really, for whatever reason, they have decided to push bridge there.
Right, so it's like snooker or any number of startups. It's like, if we just get one out of 10,000 Chinese to do this, we will be fine. Like,
Yeah, they can beat you with their numbers, that's for sure. I mean, having 1.8 billion people certainly is a good start. And, you know, eventually you're going to find some good players out of that. And they have had some successes already, and I'm sure that come down the road when all those school-age kids are old enough to play, that, you know, play tournaments, that they will be doing well. Bridge has a lot longer learning curve than a game like poker or chess. You don't see very many 12-year-olds or 15-year-olds or whatever, however old Bobby Fischer was when he was already world-class, reach that level, because you just need, there's just a lot more experience and maturity involved in Bridge than there is in chess.
Is that more true now than it was? I know chess is matured vastly in the last like 25 years, and poker, I mean, even much more over the last 15 years. Like how much higher is the bar, if any, to becoming good now? I guess maybe not much if there's not the same kind of like evolutionary energy sort of pouring into the game.
There's still a lot of evolutionary energy pouring into the game, and the game has become even more partnership oriented than it was in the past. It used to be that, you know, two good players could sit down and do real well, and now you almost would much rather have a player notch level lower than if they have a good partnership with their regular partner than to have two better players thrown together. Mm-hmm. As an example, my wife and I have been playing bridge for many years, and we have a very strong partnership. She's a world champion and has done very well in many of the women's events. And our partnership has grown a lot over the years just because we're able to, you know, discuss all the legal methods of communication, not the illegal ones that some of the bears are using, but, and we're able, and our system has evolved over the years as well. So I barriers of entry are even higher than they used to be just because of the partnership element, and also because the language of the game, of the bidding, has become so much more involved and scientific and much better than it was even as little as, say, 15 years ago. So, yeah, it's I think that might be the biggest barrier, biggest problem with Bridge, is unlike a game like poker, is the barrier to entry is just so high that it discourages people.
Yeah. Could I read that book about the blue team, say? Like, so I read a bit of the write-up that you guys featured in from the World Championships, and I don't know, I would say I understood half of it, roughly. Mm-hmm. If that's where I am with those kinds of tournament write-ups, could I understand the book about the blue team?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay.
For sure. I mean, most of the blue team stuff was from the 50s and 60s, and a lot of the examples, and I haven't gone through the whole book yet, but a lot of the examples are obvious to even, I don't want to say a bad player, but a non-experienced player, that what they're doing doesn't make sense. And they have hands where they have similar hands, and they make very different bids with them based on what their partner had. Mm. And, you know, that doesn't really take a learned player to see that. I mean, as a poker analogy, they are sometimes folding pocket aces and sometimes raising with, you know, four betting with 7-4 offsuit just because they know what everybody else has.
Yeah.
Sort of like when they, you know, whatever online site that was that had the...
Yeah, Pot Ripper, yeah.
Yeah, the whoever could see all the hole cards. I mean, it's like, you know, they could see all the cards, whether, yeah, you know, or enough of them to know what it was that they needed to do. And you can tell from just looking at the hands, as long as you have a rudimentary knowledge of the game of bridge, you would understand what it was that they were doing to cheat.
Mm. So. Yeah, very interesting.
What do you think would be lost if bridge were to sort of become, you know, just a thing that, you know, wasn't practiced culturally anymore? What would be lost with that?
To me, bridge is such a great game because it has more than one discipline, in that there's the bidding, which is like a language, and then the play, which is more like card play. And the third thing it has is the partnership cooperation element that, you know, makes it such a great game. Now, when bridge was evolving and very popular, one of the reasons it was so popular was something that, you know, two couples could sit down and play each other, and that would be their evening's entertainment. Now, obviously, that's, people entertain themselves a lot differently now than then. But that whole culture, that's already probably already gone anyway. It's never coming back. But just the ability to work together with your spouse and or your partner or whatever, whoever it is such a great part of the game. And I don't think there's any other game around that really has the same sort of partnership cooperation element that Bridge does.
Yeah. So poker could really be a little more responsible than we think for this, because not only is entertainment different and the culture of card playing is different, but probably a poker night is something that's like a lot more flexible and people can come and go, and if one person doesn't show up, you're not completely screwed, etc. So like possibly just the advantages of a poker night versus a bridge night and with the poker boom probably did something to drive a stake into the heart of bridge in America. Is that fair?
Yeah, I would say that's fair. There's a lot of just the general instant gratification thing that's also driven a stake into the heart. But the poker night certainly does make it a much more easy, you know, you can have 3 people or you can have 10 people. It doesn't matter. Everybody can play at the same time. Bridge, you can only have 4 or 8, and they have to, you know, it's a lot less flexible in terms of those things. So,
did you feel like you had any breakthroughs or aha moments or anything like that, I guess either during or in preparing for the World Series this year?
Preparing for the World Series this year? Not especially, no. I mean, I feel like I've been on a, you know, a steady learning curve of just, you know, reading various books, going on 2+2 reading site, you know, stuff there, posting some hands. The only breakthrough I could say I really had, and this is mainly due to you, Andrew, is that I joined Tournament Poker Edge, and I've watched a whole passel of your videos, and I find them to be very eye-opening in terms of the way to think about certain things that I hadn't really thought about before.
Awesome. Now we don't have to record an ad. Thank you.
Yeah, I definitely feel like I'm getting my money's worth. And anybody who's out there is listening, I would highly recommend these things. I mean, I was resisting because I'm not really a big fan of watching video, but I found that I was able to do it, and I really enjoy it, and I really feel like I've learned a lot from it, and I think it's great.
Yeah, the one thing I will say in terms of watching video, and I can't say this is true of every video producer either on, you know, Tournament Poker Edge or anywhere, but for my part at least, I do try to think about, why is this a video? Like, why am I putting this information into video form as opposed to, you know, talking about it on the podcast or putting it in a book or a blog post? Or, you know, I do try to think about the video format and, you know, what is it that, you know, you can convey in that you might not be able to convey in the same way somewhere else.
Right, yeah, and your use of like the solver and the card runners EV stuff, that really, I still don't have any of those, and I don't feel like they would necessarily help me that well, because I'm not fluent in them yet, but I can see how that definitely can help a lot, and that's something that you can, you know, I listen to a lot of podcasts, and they talk about poker strategy, but just seeing the ranges and seeing the percentages and what is happening on the various hands. That's something that video does well that you can't really do with just audio.
And I guess you've heard me say this already, but from what I've seen, your contributions on the Tournament Poker Edge forums have been great, and also I think have, you know, demonstrably increased in quality in the time that you've been posting there, which is it's great to see. It's great to see you make the progress, but it's also, you know, a nice contribution to the community as a whole. I think you're one of the better people regularly posting in the forums there.
Yeah, thanks. That's great. I mean, I think that's one of, you know, that's one way I, circling back a little bit to Bridge, is we used to, you know, go to the bar after the game and discuss the hands and such, and just having a community or a circle of friends to discuss hands, would be a poker bridge or through online or whatever, I think that's really the way to get better. And I think you've probably mentioned the idea of a poker house at the World Series where you can sit and chat with your friends and such. And if it wasn't you who mentioned, I know that some of the hosts of the Tournament Poker Edge podcast have mentioned it as well. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely a way to help to get yourself better, is to find friends. And In addition to that, I also I discuss some of my hands with some of my bridge playing poker friends. I send out a little note about, you know, I just played this tournament. Here's an interesting hand. What do you think? Did I screw this up, or should I play this better? Or you know, what can I do with these hands? And I get some feedback from that, and that helps as well. So,
are you any more or less eager to gamble at bridge now that you've played more poker?
To gamble at bridge? Well, bridge and gambling don't really go together anymore. I mean, back in the early days of bridge, rubber bridge was a big thing, and it really has basically died. And I would guess that the current generation of good players who are under 40 have probably never played rubber bridge in their life.
Okay.
And so the tournaments, and I'm sure I mentioned this last time, the tournaments are not for money prizes either. The way the money works is that you generally have a wealthy sponsor who hires a team of five other players to play, and that's where the whole money situation comes in.
Right. So Doyle Brunson building his bankroll playing Penny a Point Bridge, that's a thing of the past and possibly a legend. Yes. In the first place, but it seems pretty possible.
Very much so. They're actually one of my teammates for the Rosenblum event here in Orlando mentioned that he did used to play rubber bridge back when he lived in Toronto and Montreal. And, it's just not a thing anymore. So, The gambling. And, that may be related to the fact that the whole issue with the cheating is one thing.
Yeah.
And the whole partnership element as well. Rubber bridge used to be the idea you four people would play and you'd change partners back and forth all the time. And that, so you'd be playing for your own account, but you'd be playing with a partner and that would change and stuff. So that all has gone away. So. When I did play rubber bridge, I never really enjoyed it because you're far more at the fate of the cards than you are even in poker. And I was used to playing duplicate bridge where there is a large element of luck, but not nearly as much as there is in rubber bridge.
So playing like a genius and avoiding an overtrick and only losing $20 instead of $21 is not very satisfying to you?
No, it's not. Yeah, it's kind of frustrating watching bad players win when, there's just nothing, they didn't really do anything good. Whereas, when your opponents get a good result in duplicate, it's usually because they did something good, or occasionally it was because they were lucky, but usually they did something good against you. And you can appreciate that at least for what it is. So.
And the luck would be blundering into a better contract than everybody else got, or something like that.
It could be better because they did something skillful, or it could be better just because, just like in poker, there's essentially coin flips and bidding a slam on a finesse where you need to rely on one card being in one hand versus the other is essentially the same sort of coin flip you get in poker. So.
Right.
Yeah, that can be frustrating when you lose several of those in a row. But the difference between bridge and poker is in bridge, losing one of those generally will not cost you a tournament, whereas in poker, especially in no limit hold'em, just one of those at the wrong time and then you're just out.
Is there a big element of sort of meta-level planning in bridge where, like, if you're on the fringe of breaking into the top 64 or like just a ways out, you would be more likely to bid a risky slam and try to gain some ground on the field? Is that, like, I know in theory it's possible. Is that the sort of thing that practically you spend brain cycles on?
Yeah, I mean, yes, you can certainly adjust your strategy to try to create swings when you know that you're not the better team versus your opponents, or when you're in a tournament where you know a certain number of teams are going to qualify and you're close to that number, you may take chances to create a swing to get into the qualifying position, or vice versa, you may try to play real safely because you know you are in qualifying position and you don't want to create those swings. So yeah, that sort of playing definitely goes on.
Should we talk about a few hands from your Monster Stack tournament?
Sure. That'd be fun.
Did you have any that you were particularly interested in getting our take on or just bragging about?
Not really. I mean, I really enjoyed the one where I folded kings early in the tournament. But other than that, it's like not too many. I found all the hands I wrote about when I sent you the emails to be interesting. So yeah, whichever one you pick, I'll be happy to discuss.
No, the Kings actually was the first one that I had flagged. And this is, I guess, the first hand after the first break on day one of this tournament. And part of what I think is so interesting about it is that it's the kind of spot where I think especially early in the tournament, a lot of people might just sort of, I mean, some people are more risk averse early in the tournament, but I think it's the kind of thing where someone might just, you know, stack off with Kings. And I guess we don't know for sure that you know, you would have been wrong to stack off with Kings, but it sounds like you might have been. That someone might just kind of shrug and say, oh, well, I had Kings, what are you going to do? And have no idea that, you know, this would have turned into a final two tables finish if they had folded those Kings, right? It's the kind of run bad or whatever you want to call it, mistaken poker, where you don't fully realize the consequences of it. But like, you know, playing well in the early stage here, or at least making the play that you did make in the early stage, you know, ended up being parlayed into obviously a very deep run. And I think people tend to focus a lot on stuff that happens later in the tournament and not as much on stuff that happens early in the tournament in terms of like how it influences a deep run.
Right, right. So just to set up the hand, it was the first hand after the break, so we'd played about 2 hours. I had a pretty tight image. My opponent was not super tight, but he was playing in a very straightforward manner. It seemed like he always was betting and raising when he had it, just, you know, not being too super creative. And I think this is the first level with antes. And so I was under the gun, and I raised with pocket kings. We were about 100 blinds deep, and it folded to the villain who 3-bet. I don't remember the sizing. It's been a while, and I don't think I've noted it in my email. But so I think it was at probably like 2.5 big blinds, and then 7.5 big blinds, something on that order. And I decided I didn't want to 4-bet and fold, and I didn't really want to 4-bet and get it in with kings at the stack sizes. So I just called.
Yeah, this already I think is really good. That a lot of people feel like they have to raise again when they have kings, even, and they don't even necessarily think about, you know, whether or not they want to stack off with it. But they're just like, well, I can't not raise. I have kings, or you know, or the question is sort of like, should I call? Like, so this question will be sent to me either as a coach or a podcast host or whatever. You know, I could see this hand being sent to me with someone saying, should I have called the shove or should I have folded to the shove when I had kings? When the real question is, should I have 4-bet the kings in the first place?
Right, right, yeah. I certainly, you know, and this gets to one of the things I mentioned earlier. I didn't want to, you know, play an hour in the tournament be done, or 2 hours in the tournament be done. So, you know, that may have influenced me, but I think that it might be the right play anyway.
Yeah,
especially given that I had a tight image, so.
Yeah, I mean, I think even if there, and there likely are worse, like, I'm not saying that, you know, an under the gun, a 3-bet of an under the gun open from a straightforward player is always aces, but I do think that if you were to then 4-bet that player, you know, how many hands that are worse than kings is he continuing with? Like, you know, part of the reason for flatting is not just that, you know, I'm not ready to go broke or something, but it's just wanting to keep those worse hands in his range, or increase your prospects of potentially getting more money from those worse hands, not wanting to narrow his range down just to, you know, a range that you're not doing so well against. If, you know, if his range ends up being
right,
ace, king, and aces or something, that's not a very happy situation for you if he shoves.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And especially when you block ace, king, and so
right, yeah.
Ace is even more likely and such. So,
okay,
so anyway,
you flat with kings.
The flop was something like 10-6-3.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one diamond. I had the red kings, and we both checked, which I thought was a little suspicious that he checked behind. I thought, well, maybe he does have ace king, or maybe he has like a pair of nines or eights or something like that. He just wanted to 3-bet to see what was going on. And so I, you know, those are my thoughts on the flop. I mean, I didn't really know for sure where he was at that point. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, I have somewhat limited information at that point, but. So then the turn was the jack of diamonds, bringing a second diamond. And now I did lead into him. And once again, I'm very, very fuzzy on the pot, the size. I think I bet like half pot, something like that, though. And he very quickly raised me a substantial amount. And I started to think about the hands that I could beat. And, you know, first of all, the jack and 10 are both sets that I could very easily have. So for him to raise is a very strong play to start with. Mm-hmm. And that didn't leave very many hands I could beat. And one of the things that, you know, that definitely influenced my ability to fold now and not just call and then maybe check call the turn, the river, was the fact that I had, did have the king of diamonds. So I was blocking ace, king of diamonds, king, queen of diamonds, those sorts of hands. So he might decide that, well, I have such a good hand, I'm going to turn it into a bluff. Such a good drawing hand, but, you know, so.
So can I say one really nice thing about your thinking here is that it's obvious that you should think about what your hand looks like, but both in my own experience and especially in the experience of people who talk about things with me, when the pot gets a little bit big, especially in like a tournament situation, they start to think a lot more about like, oh, can my opponents have the nuts? And a lot less about like, what does my hand look like? And this is true to such a degree that when you said what you said, I almost heard you as having said like, oh, he could easily have jacks or tens, instead of what you actually said, which is that like, my hand looks exactly like jacks and tens, just because I think most people would be so quick to focus much more on that former thing. So I do want to say, like, we all know to think about what our hand looks like, but especially when the pot gets a little bit big and when we start worrying about the nuts, that can go away sometimes. So it's nice that you kept an eye on that, and a lot of people don't.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm a little curious just to know, what was your, I guess, objective in betting the turns? I mean, you kind of said you found the check behind on the flop a little suspicious. What was the thinking behind betting the turn?
Well, it was more, you know, I did think that he might have like a medium-ish pair that he would be willing to call with, you know, thinking that I have ace-king that I'm bluffing with or something. Or he may decide that, you know, I felt like if I was going to check, that I would certainly feel like I would be forced to call on the turn anyway. So I figured I might as well do the betting myself. And, you know, if he does raise, I feel like I can fold. And if he does call, then, you know, then I'll have to reevaluate on the river. But I felt like there were hands that he could call me with that were worse. And I, you know, that's sort of what I'm, where I'm going with this. So I definitely felt like I couldn't check and fold at this point. I thought that would be like way too, I mean, obviously I was playing the hand in a somewhat exploitive way by folding it anyway, but just check folding would certainly be too weak for this hand. So I feel like bet folding was better.
And implicit here is the idea that he was not going to bet ace king for you. So like if he's betting a lot of his hands, like all of them or something, including all his bluffs, then you would rather check. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. But like I said, I felt like this player was just not going to be bluffing too much unless he had really like a super big draw, or just had this feeling like I was super weak or something. But, you know, raising under the gun and calling a three bet, obviously I just don't have a weak hand there. So, you know, none of these things seemed like they were going to happen.
Yeah, and I think this is an important thing that even once you've resolved that you're going to put a bet in on the turn, whether either you bet or you check and call, and you've also determined that you think your hand is kind of reasonably strong, but not, you know, relative to your own range or the villain's range, you know, your hand is not incredibly strong. A lot of people then default to saying, well, therefore I should check and call, right? Betting is for strong hands, and checking and calling is what you do with marginal hands. And I don't think that's really correct logic, but I think that is where a lot of people go with it. I think the more important thing is to say, is my value, like when I'm putting this bet in on the turn, I can either check and call and that gets value from bluffs, or I can bet and that gets value from the like marginal hands in my opponent's range that are worse than mine. And then the question is, which of those things is the better source of value? And especially if you think you're dealing with an opponent who's not going to bluff very much, then I think, you know, betting is certainly the better source of value than checking and thinking that you're going to induce. Really, I mean, you need to induce a disproportionate amount of bluffing to really make bluff catching, you know, calling the turn, you're just sort of hoping to be up against a bluff heavy range. If you think that he's, or I mean, maybe you think he's going to value bet some hands that are worse than kings, but, you know, he'll certainly call with those hands if he's going to value bet them.
Right, right. That last part was the most important part. I thought he would definitely call with the hands that he would have bet with anyway. And it just didn't seem like check calling was the right strategy. So
yeah,
maybe it was just partly just, all right, I have a good hand, I want to put the money in the pot too. You know, it's sort of like that's not the way you should be thinking, but you know, it's sort of, you know,
it kind of is.
And some of the hands,
it's not wildly wrong.
Right. But you know, whether or not you're going to get called by the right hands or not, that's another thing. But and there was a hand that I did misplay later in the tournament where I did have this. I have a great hand, but it's check raise kind of thinking, and you know, that was definitely wrong. So.
I really could see myself checking in the spot, especially if it's early in the tournament and my opponent seems straightforward but is still basically unknown. Would either of you say that's like a bad play? I mean, my thinking would be my hand is quite safe against basically all reasonable holdings that my opponent could have. You know, with a hand like queens, I would be a little more excited about betting and you know, either folding out or getting a call from ace-king. If I check now, I can value bet the river, and my hand looks a little bit weaker. Would you say that's a bad play?
I don't think so. I think checking is a viable option. I more just wanted to get at the thought process, I guess, in that you don't really want to be thinking of the hand as a bluff catcher. So if you're thinking your thinking there, Nate, is still oriented towards how do I get value from the marginal part of his range. I think you're more just saying I might actually more effectively accomplish that by checking the turn, and you know, I guess you're kind of anticipating the part of the game tree where it goes check check and then you value bet the river, which I think is different than expecting that your value is going to come primarily from check calling and inducing bluffs.
Right.
Sorry for the background noise.
No, that's okay.
I'll also say that part of the value of checking is retaining the option to check fold if the bet size is scary or if you get a physical something.
Yeah.
Or, yeah, I mean, it's like the check to side, I guess. Maybe I'm a live fish, but I like that.
I think there's something to that.
One of the things I still struggle with at this stage in my poker development is interpreting opponents' bet sizing tells, whether, you know, they're betting big because they're bluffing or they're betting big because they've got it versus they're betting small because they're, you know, that whole, you know, dynamic is at the interpreting bet sizing. So I don't really necessarily trust myself to make a good read on somebody's sizing. Now I feel like I can make a read on their physical stuff as to whether they're comfortable and happy about their bets or not, but I think I do struggle still with the interpreting and processing their bet sizing tells.
Yeah, but not all of that is psychological. Some of it is just, like, formal. If you check here and he pots it in your face, like yeah, that's going to be a tell from a lot of people, but also, like, you're in a narrow range situation. Aces beat you, jacks beat you, tens beat you. Like, does he really have that many bluffs? Is he really value betting? Like, he's not value betting anything worse in this situation for that sizing, I don't think. So you can just fold. and that's not a psychological matter. That's a formal one. And I could be wrong about that. We'd have to, like, run it through a PO solver or something. But it's not all psychology at this point.
Yeah, I understand that. He may still feel like queens or nines are a value bet at this point because he may think I have ace king, and he may just, you know, all right, I'm going to bet the pot because you can't call me with your ace king and go away with his pocket nines or something like that. So, whereas I think that if I bet, he's just going to call with that hand 100% of the time. I don't think he's ever raising the nines. That's sort of, you know, that's how where I'm coming from on this hand.
Yeah, I mean, if when you bet he calls with ace-king or nines a lot, then please bet a lot.
yeah. I think most villains would call once with nines there just because, you know.
Yeah, so I think...
But don't do that. It's not a good play. But don't, right? Yeah.
But I think it's a good lay down. I think in particular, you know, this is not a spot when you get raised on the turn. I think it's a spot that you don't really see straightforward players having a bluffing range. You know, I think if he wants to bluff, so my kind of rule of bluffing for most players really, but certainly straightforward players, is they don't bluff that much. B, they particularly don't do it when, like, they like to keep it simple and they like to keep it cheap. So, you know, right. just c-betting the flop is sort of a very simple, relatively cheap bluff that he could make if he had, say, ace-king, and he just wanted to try to, you know, take the pot down. I mean, he's not even really probably getting better hands to fold with ace-king. But then to check the flop and then raise the turn is much more expensive than betting the flop, and it's much more kind of complicated. And in theory, you know, he's getting some new information when you bet the turn, so he might have a hand like ace-king where he checks the flop thinking that he has showdown value, and then when you bet the turn, he decides he doesn't have showdown value anymore, and like, there are reasons why he should have a bluffing range in this situation, but I think that a lot of straightforward players don't think in those terms. They just, you know, they're not going to take a complicated line like this as a bluff, and I think you're also not going to see it for thin value. So you're not going to see him with queens, you know, checking the flop and then suddenly thinking he's going to get thin value by like raising the turn with, you know, with the bottom of his range kind of.
Exactly. Yes. That's exactly why I felt I could fold this. It's like I thought about the best hand that I could beat, which was queens, and I didn't think he would play it that way. So sort of like that was sort of sealed the deal.
Yeah, and I think that's a great thought process or a good heuristic to use.
Yeah.
Once you're at the point where you're not beating anything in his value range, there's not really a lot of value. Like, if it's just a matter of he has a polarized range, like either he can beat kings or he's bluffing, that's already a bad spot. Even if he has like an optimal bluffing frequency, there's already not really value there. Like, calling in those spots tends to be roughly break even if you're just, you have a bluff catcher against a polarized range. And then if on top of that we figure he probably doesn't bluff as much as he should, well, then calling in that spot becomes downright bad. Like, the only time you really make money by calling is when you can beat hands in your opponent's value range, or when you have like a really significant blocker.
Right. I actually had a bluff blocker though, so that made it
exactly
worse the other way.
Yeah.
Having the king of diamonds was just another, you know, definite reason to fold there. So.
What was the hand where you thought you made a big mistake by fast playing a strong hand or check raising a strong hand? You said.
Ace king of diamonds on day three, and I raised from under the gun and got three bet by the only other big stack of the table, and the flop was king, and I don't remember the two of the cards, something like six deuce, but giving me a four flush as well as top pair, top kicker, and I check raised pretty big in a situation where it just felt like afterwards I was thinking to myself, well, what is he going to call me with here? That, you know, it's like there are two hands that I'm really afraid of, and those are not going to do, you know, I'm not doing very well against them. I'm not doing terribly against aces. I mean, I still have some outs, but I'm not doing great against them. I guess I have 11 or 12 outs, whatever it is, twice. But if he puts it all in, it's like I'm just going to be an ugly spot for me. And my hand plays great as a check call because there's, you know, he's basically drawing dead if he's behind. He might have one out if he has, like, a pair and hits his set, and it doesn't make me a flush, and I can still redraw to that. And it just seemed like it was just I have a great hand, this is a great flop, let's raise, as opposed to I have a great hand, this is a great flop, let's let him keep betting. So I felt like that was clearly the worst hand I played. You know, you may feel differently from the hands that I sent you, but I was not happy with that hand afterwards when I went back and reanalyzed and thought about what was going on.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly inclined to agree that it's a pretty big mistake. And I would say part of the reason for that also is that this particular spot where you've called a three bet, I mean, it's very similar to this hand, right? You've raised from early position, you've called a three bet when you're out of position. It's not really a situation where you're kind of meant to be driving the action very much. Like, your opponent's range in this situation should be a lot stronger than yours. You're probably four betting a lot of your strongest hands. I mean, arguably, even ace king suited is like, you know, borderline close enough to say, like, I don't think anyone would say it was awful if you just stuck this in pre-flop. So, you know, you've even just having ace king at all, you're already like a stronger hand than some people might even have in this situation. So there's just very few, right. You probably don't have aces, you probably don't have kings, queens isn't a strong enough hand to check raise on this flop. You also probably don't have the sets. I mean, I wouldn't really, depending on the size of the three bet, but I probably wouldn't advise, you know, raise calling like pocket fives pre-flop. So there's not really, like, you don't really have hands that want to check raise and get the money. And, you know, you have a bunch of bluff catchers. If the villain continues to bet, you have a bunch of bluff catchers. And so despite the fact that it's a really good flop for you, ace-king is not really a value hand. It's just a very good bluff catcher right now. I mean, obviously, if it improves to a flush, it's going to be a different story. But right now, what you have is just a very good bluff catcher, more so than anything else. And, you know, the one hand that you mentioned is a possible getting value from would be like if he had king queen, which, you know, whether he's even three betting you with that in the first place is, you know, certain, which I know you realize is certainly debatable.
Right. Right.
And, you know, whether he calls a three bet with it, and, you know, you can get the value from king queen from other ways, like more money. If he has king queen, some more money is going to go into the pot almost no matter what happens. You don't really need to check raise the flop to get that value.
I agree with all of that, and, you know, I just felt terrible afterwards when I thought about the hand more carefully, both at the table, which I try not to do too much, mm-hmm. but I, you know, make a note of the hand, and then later on that night or the next day or when I write up the hands, I was thinking, like, you know, the more I thought about it, the less I liked the play. So
I think the making note of the hand, I think, is really great advice, and that's something I try to advise people to do, because I mean, I suffer from this, you know, probably as much as anyone, after I play a hand, either that I suspect that I misplayed, or I'm just kind of not sure. I guess that's the same thing. I'm not sure that I played it as well as I could have. It's tempting to ruminate on that, whether or not you get a good outcome, but, you know, more commonly when you don't get a good outcome, it's tempting to ruminate on that, but at the same, and I mean, that is how you get better also, is by reflecting on mistakes or potential mistakes that you may have made, but the time to do that is not while you're still playing, trying to make more, you know, good decisions going forwards. And I think that writing it down and making a commitment and having a plan for how you're going to review it later, I find that a very helpful way of getting it out of my head, of saying, like, look, we are going to think about this, just kind of explaining to my brain, okay, we are going to think about this, we're not going to do it right now,
right.
Let's write it down, push it out of the brain, deal with it later.
Yeah, that's sort of what I do. And, you know, that also, circling back to bridge, is a key thing. It's, you know, you get the negative reinforcement of a bad result, and if you let it carry over to future hands. In poker, you know, you may misplay your ace-king, and the next four hands you have seven deuce, and you can just fold and not be worrying about it. But you're in there playing another hand right away in bridge, and you don't have that luxury of, well, I can just fold and stew a little bit and whatever. So, yeah, being able to make a note of it in poker is more important, but also because in bridge we have records of every hand we played. So we don't need to, I don't even need to make a note of a hand. It's just, you know, I can go online and see every hand I played since I've been here in Orlando, see what the result was, see what everybody else's hands were, and see what errors I made. In poker, you sort of need to make a note of it, and then as best as you can, to clear it out of your head, as you mentioned, is that's really a very important skill too.
You mentioned one other thing in your report that I thought was noteworthy in a good way. I guess this is the end of day three. You were saying, you know, you were really exhausted. I know you're not accustomed to playing multiple days in a row, which, I mean, it's tiring for anyone, but especially, you know, if you've kind of gone out of your way typically to not do that. And then this is also, you know, some of the highest stakes, I guess, that you've played. It's very, you know, psychologically intense at this point and emotionally fraught.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're going to play six more hands, and, you know, psychologically you're done. You're ready for the day to be over. And,
right.
You know, so part of you, like, I think it's tempting to read something like that and think, like, oh, that's a weakness, and, you know, you need to be able to just play your best straight on through all the way to the end. And I don't even think that's completely wrong, but at the same time, it's a little unrealistic. And I think the most important thing is just to be able to acknowledge that it's happening. You know, to just be able to say, look, I'm tired. And, yeah, I mean, if I get dealt pocket tens, I'm going to play it. But when it's a more marginal hand, like, I think it's okay to just give yourself permission to say, you know, opening a hand like ace 10 offsuit under the gun is pretty marginal, and it's something that I might do when I'm feeling my sharpest. But when I'm not feeling my sharpest, I'm, you know, at worst, whatever I'm giving up theoretically is not very high. And it's quite possible, if I'm not going to play my best, that I really am better off just folding this hand.
Right. Yeah, for sure. And I definitely had that mentality, but, you know, as I said, you know, they dealt me a couple of hands that I felt like I had to play. So there I was. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think I've noticed that in some of your old books as well, where you're thinking, well, it's late at night and I've resolved to tighten down. And then all of a sudden the hand they gave me was too good. So I couldn't. No, so it's the same idea.
Yeah. But I have an unpleasant history of, playing hands badly in the final stage of the day of a WSOP main event. So it's something I've been conscious of.
Yeah, you mentioned that. Well, maybe it's because you're eating the cookie too soon.
Thanks so much for coming on the show, Danny, and good for you. It's exciting to see you doing so well, and I hope we stay in touch.
Great. Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, congratulations.
All right. Thank you. Have a good day. Bye.
Devotion of a Carmelite, or the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law? I know you want.